As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show. It's Tuesday, January 23rd. Happy Hall of Fame Announcement Day to those who look forward to that sort of thing. We are recording this about 4 hours before the official word comes down. I think by the time you listen to this, Adrian Beltre will have received the call. Probably Joe Mauer, and then some combination of Todd Helton, Billy Wagner, and or Gary Sheffield. This is based on some of the great work that at Not Mr. Tibbs on Twitter has been doing, gathering the ballots from BBWAA members throughout the entire process. So Hall of Fame chatter coming on the next episode once we have that information. Lots of what's going on with this winter. Why are things going so slowly? A lot of that kind of happening here over the course of the next 45 minutes or so. But I wanted to start today with a signing that actually did happen. Josh Hader signed a 5-year, $95 million deal with the Astros, a team that had a proven closer in Ryan Pressly. They talked to Ryan Pressly about it first, apparently got his blessing in some form, and now the best available reliever on the market joins a team that didn't necessarily need that exact piece, but definitely makes the Houston bullpen better. So, Britt, how surprised were you by the Astros being the team that actually threw the big contract at Hader, especially given the spending patterns in free agency with Jim Crane's ownership?
Very. But, you know, our Ken Rosenthal mentioned a few days before that you know, the Astros had emerged as serious players. And this time of year, guys, you're always like, okay, is that real? Or, you know, are they just trying to pump up the market so that someone else in their division overpays, right? Like, you know, you just don't know. But Ken seemed very convinced that this was legitimate interest. Obviously, it ends up being legitimate interest. I think for the Astros, this to me signifies something that is a stark departure from, as you mentioned, what we've seen Jim Crane do. I am curious if this is more a hallmark that Dana Brown really wants to have happen, right? If this is something that, you know, he came from Atlanta, he felt like, let's keep this strength and turn it into more of a strength. Let's turbocharge up that bullpen and see where the chips fall. I do think that anything that happens in Houston has to go through Crane. So I am curious how much of this idea was Dana's, how much of it was Jim Crane's. I think either way, it's a move that makes Houston considerably better because, as you mentioned, they have not one but two closers. So now you have shortened the game where if you get to the seventh inning, you feel much better about it. You've shipped everybody up. And their bullpen, this is the team that's already good. Their bullpen wasn't in shambles by any state of the game at all. I mean, they're a team that historically is very right-handed heavy in the bullpen. There's years, multiple years, where they don't have lefties at all. I think when you look at Houston and you look at some of the moves they've made, we keep waiting for this window to close on them and on this like competitive window, and they just keep keeping it ajar. And things like this continue to show that, like, hey, Houston is still going for it. Right? The window is still open. And Crane has been pretty adamant that while he owns the team, there will be no more tanking and rebuilding, that they're going to keep this train going. And I wonder if this signifies a little bit of a shift in philosophy that, yes, we are going to pony up this kind of money. I mean, this is a huge deal for a reliever. This is a guy who instantly makes your team better. I did not have this on my bingo card at all, guys. Houston would have been like one of the last teams I think I would have picked. Certainly, you know, Oakland and Colorado and those teams that aren't trying. But when you look at competitive teams, this would have been one of the last teams I picked just based on their spending habits, based on their needs. But the more you look at it, and Chandler Rome did a great job dissecting this deal and kind of what it means and, you know, going through how they spoke to Presley, I like it. I think it is smart. I think it is different. And I think it is a little brazen. And if this is a move that was spearheaded by Dana Brown, I'm very curious to see what he is able to do moving forward, because I think, you know, the first year on the job, you spend so much time trying to figure out what's going on. And then you settle into it, and then you make these real moves. So this is kind of the winter where we're maybe seeing some tendencies out of a new front office in Houston. I don't know. That's kind of what I take out of it.
Yeah, I think in the context of the short and long-term windows and how these Astros are built, I think this is a big shot at the short-term. I know it's a long-term deal, but this is a team that is now projected to be the fourth best team in baseball. And you know, they also are going to lose a fair amount of people off of this core in the short term. Jose Altuve's contract is up. Alex Bregman's contract is up. Mm-hmm. You know, Ryan Presley has a mutual option next year. You know, so there's some people that are leaving. I think, you know, this is sort of like haters going to take over for Presley when he leaves. That's the long-term part. But the short-term part was, what do we do in the playoffs? How do we win in the playoffs? How do we get past this? Because if you look at the Houston Astros as they are built, I would say the biggest weakness is the back end of the rotation. I mean, you got Fromber and Justin Verlander at the top, but Christian Javier had problems last year. Hunter Brown had an awful second half. And JP France, you know, maybe a competent number five, but it's not like the sort of depth of starting pitchers that you're used to Houston having. And I don't really see, you know, the farm providing more after that. They're going to be a much better team if Lance McCullers comes back next year. And that's a sort of a scary statement to say, because Lance has pitched so little recently. So I would have thought that they would spend on a starting pitcher, but I think that they're saying, you know what, no matter all of that, like, we're going to make the postseason. And so all that matters in the postseason is, who's your number one, who's your number two, and who are your best two relievers? Like, those four pitchers are going to pitch, you know, 60 to 70% of your innings in modern baseball in a playoff series. So that's why they went and got a Hader.
Yeah, I mean, they're top five relievers now. Hader, Presley, Brian Abreu, Rafael Montero, and one of Ronel Blanco, Dylan Coleman, maybe Forrest Whitley. He's finally healthy and throwing real, real hard. Looks good on social. We'll see if it, I hope for his sake, it shows up in spring and he's ready to go, because it'd be fun to see what he could do. He's just filthy.
Hey, looks good on social is the new best shape of his life.
Yeah, yeah, I'm totally trying to come up with a new way of saying it. I think there's a couple things with the Astros that are really going to be key to them not having a dip. You mentioned all the players they could potentially lose this offseason. Maybe they don't retain Altuve and Bregman, but you lose one, you got to find a way to replace the other. Verlander could be gone at the end of the season too. He's got an option. He could retire. Like, that's always a possibility for Verlander, given the stage of life he is in. Yeah, that's a nice way to call someone old. But you look at Christian Javier as a guy that could have a big bounce back season potentially, and Hunter Brown is a young pitcher that we really like. If you can get those two things to happen, that rotation looks a lot better. I think where they really start to run into some trouble is with a couple of injuries, because if you look at prospect list for the Astros, their best prospects are not great in the first place, and they're almost all position players. You do not see a lot of highly regarded pitchers in this organization right now. In addition to McCullers, they do have Luis Garcia working back from Tommy John surgery. So we could flip the calendar to maybe July or August. He could be back in the rotation. That could be a nice lift for them down the road. But I think starting pitching depth is one area where they need to do a little bit more. They're a top five team in payroll as of right now, according to Kotz. And that's a good thing. I think if you're trying to keep that window open as long as possible, I look at this core and I think, is Yainer Diaz going to be a star as an everyday catcher? Is he going to be a secondary piece of this lineup? We love the power. Just a question of whether the plate skills come together and the defensive work behind the plate. If they lose anything, not having Maldonado, that could be something that impacts the pitching staff as well. So there are some questions, but this team still looks like the favorite in the AL West. They're a legitimate World Series contender, even as they're currently built. And it leads me to one final question. Do you believe they're done? Or do you think there's another smaller signing or a possible trade in the works?
I think they're going to add more. I think I saw they're still looking for like a left-handed hitting outfielder. So I think there's some roster tweaking that can still go on. Listen, usually at this time of the year, we're talking about just like, you know, some roster depth, but there are so many free agents still available right now. It is crazy. It has been such a slow moving hot stove that there is plenty of room to still improve. I think I saw on FanGraphs the other day that there was like free agents had like a combined 80 WAR. So like there is still like a ton of potential out there. I think they do make a move. It's not going to be some huge move. We, you know, we know that they're not going to be probably a player for these top end pitchers that are still available. But I do think adding another outfielder makes sense, gives them a little bit more depth. I do think, as you guys said, they're still the team to beat in the AL West. So even if they do something minor, they're still set up very well. You know, I wouldn't count them out. I don't think that they've had most teams really haven't had a super busy offseason. And I think we're going to see a lot more moves in the beginning part of spring training than we have in quite some time.
Yeah, maybe it does spill over that far. Looking at some of the names, you think about basically Michael Brantley replacements is what it amounts to. Yeah. Left-handed hitting corner outfielders. Jock Peterson is like trended so far down the DH path. I'm not sure you'd look at him and say you want to put him out there often, but maybe with that smaller left field in Houston, you could make that work. Eddie Rosario's out there. I mean, maybe that's the bin they're shopping in because it's not like they need a move that puts them over the top. They just need that sort of depth move. The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting was that when you look at the Twins, we're going to get into more detail about them in just a little bit. Max Kepler might be a guy that's on the move. They're a team that's not spending as much as they did last year. They're among the teams currently dealing with the uncertainty with their TV deal. Kepler is in his final year before free agency. And part of the value of a player like that is if you look at him and say, we'd like to give him a qualifying offer, you want to get him before the season because you can't offer a qualifying offer if you trade for that player after the season starts. I think he could be someone they move, not only because of present cost, but because of what they have on the roster and trying to make all the pieces fit there. He could actually be a pretty good fit in Houston, especially right. With the year he just had.
I just think the Astros are done because I see a $254 million luxury tax payroll estimate on FanGraphs, and the second threshold is $257. I think that lines up too good.
Unless they trade, they could trade. They could make a trade.
They could make a trade and somebody has to pay some of the money. But I think that what you leave a $3 million cushion for is a September trade. And so I think, you know, if you're talking about finding a lefty, you know, maybe a minor league free agent or something, I mean, like John Singleton, you know, could be just their lefty that they use, just a DH and play Alvarez in the field, you know, when Singleton is DHing. So, you know, that's your lefty. That's what I think.
It could be somebody on a minor league deal that makes the roster, something a little bit smaller that ultimately gets it done. But I think the window is open. And as far as the longer term window, it's going to hinge on Dana Brown being as effective as he was in the VP of scouting role for Atlanta. He was there with Michael Harris, Spencer Strider, some of the really big hits Atlanta's had in recent drafts. And if the Astros start doing that, that's going to change things for them in the long haul in a big way.
What I'm hearing out of Houston that is bad, that I don't like, is that there's a real turn away from analytics. I think that's unfortunate because they were the real standard bearer for, you know, analytics, player development, and sort of a progressive organization in that way. And they've lost an AGM that is dedicated to analytics, and they replaced him with an AGM that's dedicated to scouting. So I think that's a really kind of a hard turn away from the thing that has been their strength. But listening to us talk about, you know, how bad their prospects are right now and extending the window, maybe there's something kind of smart about it. It's like we've been doing it that way for a while, and it's been really good, but we kind of maybe need to switch it up to keep the window open because we need to like get better pieces into the organization to even have. So we're going to like rely on organizational inertia to keep the player development processes, the ones that are good, in place. And then we're gonna switch it around and put more investment in the scouting side to give them better pieces so that we can, just as like Yordan Alvarez and, you know, Kyle Tucker and Yainer Diaz, the next crew, as they are getting a little bit older, we've got the new wave of kids, you know? So,
yeah,
you know, maybe that's the thought process behind it. Maybe they think they can do both things by being like, we've developed all this analytics, we've developed all this player development, let's now develop the scouting and put some money in that. But I think you can do all that and still have an AGM dedicated to analytics. So the loss of Saragelli's, you know, they're going to lose some more pieces, I think, from the analytics department over the next year plus. And so, you know, it's weird that they can't try and do both things at the same time, but there's definitely been a change in organizational philosophy over there in Houston.
Yeah. Choosing not to try to do both of those things at the same time is a curious choice, but we'll see. We'll see what it costs them in the long run.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
A few other recent moves: Robert Stevenson to the Angels, Aroldis Chapman to the Pirates, and James Paxton, it sounds like, is going to the Dodgers, because if the Dodgers went a week without making a move, I don't know what we would do. We'd panic. We'd be worried. But kind of working in reverse order, Paxton for me is the kind of guy that any team in need of pitching should just take the chance on. It's a one-year deal. It's probably about $11 million plus incentives based on the reports that we're seeing here as of late Tuesday morning. That's nothing. Every team out there that needs a starting pitcher could do that. It's almost at the point, though, where you wonder if everyone's offering roughly the same contract and you're in James Paxton's position, you just choose the best team. So in that case, the Dodgers win because nobody else wants to give you the extra couple million dollars. So I don't know. I find that to be a little bit frustrating. He fits into a rotation that's like the Swiss cheese method, right? You have all these guys that have injury histories. As long as you have a combination of five of them that are healthy at any given time, you're going to be just fine. And if your best five stay healthy for most of the season, you're going to be absolutely filthy. So not a guy that I thought they needed, but I like it in the sense that we've seen flashes from Paxton, even around all of the injuries, that there's still a really good pitcher in there.
Yeah. And I think the Dodger system is so good that if you're a guy looking to stay healthy, looking to, you know, sign a one-year deal, maybe reestablish it, you know, what you can do, why wouldn't LA be at the top of that list, right? For everything they've been able to do in development at the big league level, for every, you know, I think, you know, the players have, every player you talk to raves about the way they're treated, the resources at their disposal, the coaching, you know, it's probably the most well-run organization in the sport. So I agree. I wasn't saying, hey, the Dodgers should make another move. Actually, I was talking to someone in the Dodgers front office last week and he was joking around. He's like, I don't know when to go on vacation. We're just busy every second, which is true. They are. They're busy every second. But if I'm James Paxton, I'm looking at this as a really solid offer. First off, you know, people who say that, you know, the game, you know, so many teams are cutting back. Like, why are the Twins cutting payroll, right? But if James Paxton is still getting $11 million, I think the sport's in a pretty healthy place. And I think on the flip side of that, if you're the Dodgers, you're looking at a guy who has a lot of potential upside if he can stay healthy and you feel pretty confident in your systems and in your development that you can, you know, try, you know, you have a pretty good chance of getting a good James Paxton on the field.
Yeah, I guess the other thing real quick, I'll throw it to you next. You know, I think about someone like Paxton against the likes of a Lance Lynn or a Kyle Gibson. And again, the final dollar total isn't exactly the same, but it's these 1 year stop gaps. I think if you're a team like the Dodgers, there's other teams that have young depth they can turn to. You have the luxury of gambling on the high risk, high reward. If you're the Cardinals and you don't have as many starters that you feel are big league ready, you got to go the innings route. You have to go the bulk route and hope that home run rate or whatever the skills flaw is, isn't as bad as it was. And the thing that led you to the discount can't still be the problem when you shop in the other bin.
You know what's wild? That's a great segue to what I was going to say about the Dodgers. Do you know who led the Dodgers in innings last year?
Bobby Miller.
It's really close. Clayton Kershaw with 130, Bobby Miller with 124. Their fifth starter the fifth most innings by a starter went to Michael Grove with 69. Wow. So they don't care about innings. They do not buy innings on the market. They only want quality. And what they've figured out, I think, is they basically have a six-man rotation. They've never announced it. They've never told anybody that they're doing it. They've never said it in those words. They don't want to ask. They don't want their manager answering questions about the six-man rotation. But if you look at how they use their pitchers, more than half the time, they do it on an extra day of rest. So that's another thing you can sell to James Paxton. Be like, hey, we're not asking you to go out there every 5 days. You know, like, we're going to give you a lot of extra rest days. Anytime you want an IL blow, that's fine. We have all these young pitchers that are coming in that at the very least can do some spot starting with this great offense that we put together. And then we also have like Emmett Sheehan, who like is probably good for 100 innings next year of pretty good stuff at the major league level. So, you know, that's, I think, part of the way that they think about things, the way they run things. Maybe that is not obvious when you look at them on paper. You kind of always just look at their starters and be like, okay, they've got Bobby Miller, they've got this guy. No, it's they plan for 10 and they plan for nobody to really go over 140 innings. You know, so think about that in fantasy, because this is something I discovered when I was trying to rank Emmett Sheehan for my fantasy ranks. I was like, wow, Emmett Sheehan make it 80 innings next year. You know, and he might be like the fourth most on the Dodgers with 80 innings. So that's not how they think things. The other thing that's interesting about James Paxton for me is he got his velo back post-injury. He had a big injury. I think it was a TJ or something, but he had a surgery, came back. He got his fastball velo back, but he hasn't gotten his breaking ball velo back. And I asked him about that late last season, and he was just like, I don't know. And he's like, it's better than not having my fastball velo back. Like, I'll take the fastball velo, but I do need to throw this breaking ball harder. And I've been trying to figure it out. So, you know, on some level, you're hoping that Mark Pryor, or maybe another year, another offseason of rehab of regular preparation allows him to throw that breaking ball faster. But he needs, you know, a couple ticks on the breaking ball, not necessarily the fastball. But they must think, hey, you know, how rare is it that somebody, you know, gets the fastball velo back but never gets the breaking ball velo back? Maybe they're just saying, like, that doesn't happen usually.
Yeah, that does seem a bit odd. It's not something I've noticed in the past, at least, for guys coming back from that. Usually, if you see that drop, it's everything is down across the board. Chapman to the Pirates. I mean, if they're contending, he's there. He's a setup guy for David Bednar all season. If they're not contending, he's probably on a playoff team in the sixth or seventh inning, right? It's the same script the Royals ran. Yeah.
Some really great talent has been traded for Aroldis Chapman over the years.
Yeah.
Right.
Just keeps basically going. The Aroldis Chapman trade tree is immensely fruitful for teams that sign it.
Yeah, true. That'd be a great story. That's
Gleyber
true.
Torres, Cole Reagans. I'm sure there's more I'm not thinking of.
The Pirates are just trying to tap into that, really. They're not even thinking about Chapman making their bullpen better, because it's like, it's a marginal improvement, sure, whatever. But it's the player you get back later. That's the thing that's going to make your team a lot better. Stevenson's really interesting, because we are people who love saves on this show. I mean, actually, I don't know. Britt, how do you feel about saves? Eno and I love them because we have to love them for fantasy
purposes.
We're
required for fantasy? To love them. Yeah.
How do you feel about saves?
I was gonna say, we love them?
Yeah. You think saves are ridiculous?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I don't think they're ridiculous. You mean as a stat? How do I feel? Yeah. Or evaluating a player? It's ridiculous, I think, in player evaluation, because there's so many other factors that go into things.
Yeah.
Then saves. And then part of the reason, part of the problem, I think, is that you have guys who are less hesitant or you know, more hesitant, I guess is the better word, to pitch the seventh, eighth innings, because all the glory comes from the ninth inning and the saves. You know, like, I know we have holds and all these other made up things, but what gets you paid is the saves and the ninth innings, right? So when you have teams that do these closer by committees, that leads sometimes to some internal strife in the clubhouse, guys who are facing arbitration, things like that. So I think there are pros and cons when we are evaluating saves, because if you're a closer on a bad team, you just don't get that many save opportunities, right?
Yeah. I think unless...
And then actually the rest of your bullpen matters too.
Right. You know? Yeah, you need a lot of other things.
Exactly. If you have no bridge...
You have to be able to protect some of the leads that you have to create those opportunities.
It's also become a thing where certain guys, like, why are closers so bad in non-save situations? Right?
Because yeah, there's an adrenaline component, I think, for some of those guys.
And it's a mental component for guys coming into these games that are 7-1 versus 2-1. Right. It's just a different component. So I do think teams are getting away slowly. Lots of teams are getting away from just that one traditional guy. And maybe what we're seeing in Houston now is we're going to see more of, right? Is teams kind of saying, like, well, and I guarantee, you know, the Houston is going to say this in spring training, like Joe Espada is going to be like, well, we look at it as we have two options to close every night, and we're going to play the matchups, and we're going to play who's got more rest, and, you know, things like that, which isn't great for either of those guys. Well, you know, it's fine for Hader. He's already got the money, but it's not great if you're Presley and, you know, you could get your option declined and you're going to hit the open market. And it'd be a lot better if you had 40, 50 saves under your belt than if you have half of that, or if you're relegated to be an eighth inning guy. So there are a lot of layers, I think, in the game to the save stat. And I think there is a lot of, there's been a lot of pushback in recent years over what does it mean and how does it impact the game? And does it actually help you win games to have just one guy who collects 50 saves or a group of several guys and you play the matchups and you play the rest? I think teams would often prefer the latter because it's cheaper and you don't have to pay for that one big name closer, but players love the big name closer because that is how they get paid.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is an arbitration problem, especially. Mm-hmm. Arbitration is one of those places that leans very heavily on old stats and saves get rewarded. So
yes,
that's going to make you want to get saves if you are a reliever. Stevenson ends up in a place where he should pretty easily be the closer if they want one guy to close out games. He is the best reliever the Angels have. He's a significant upgrade over Carlos Estevez, who led the team in saves last year. I'm curious, you know, as you look at the changes Stevenson has made over the course of his time as a reliever, how sticky do you think the changes are? The success he had, a 3.10 ERA, 0.88 whip last season, is he going to be among the league's best relievers as he continues forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the things he did, he's going to continue to do. You know, what he did in Tampa was basically firm up his breaking ball or replace it with a cutter, however you want to say it. But he went from a slider to a cutter. And then he also just started using the poop out of it. I mean, he was throwing his cutter like 60% of the time in August. And that is a nasty pitch, and he should throw it a ton. Actually, it was 3/4 of the time in August and September. So I think that's, you know, that's something that, you know, is he's going to continue doing that. And he had great success with it. And the modeling numbers love that change. And so I think that's a good way to go. The one thing that I would push back on is that I'm just not sure that he's going to immediately step into the closer role. You know, there's always the value, not the value of inertia, but just the fact of inertia. Like, you know, Estevez was the closer. So he is the closer until he loses the closer role, maybe. I expect Estevez to get, you know, 10 plus saves this year. Maybe Stevenson will get more.
I'll take the under on 10 for Estevez. New manager with Ron Washington. I think roles like that with a new manager, it's a clean slate. You start over.
Maybe, or he's old school and says this is our guy until he's not our guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I was thinking. He's pretty old school.
Yeah, he's pretty old school, and so therein, he says, we have Estevez until he fails so much that all of a sudden we have to use somebody else. I don't know. This is my own opinion only. I like Ron Washington. I'm curious to see what he does there. But
Britt, I think you are a uniquely position to describe Anthony Rendon as someone who's covered him before in like his comments and comments from a former teammate that he hates baseball, because all of this started. Rendon did an interview and said, "We got to shorten the season, man.
Yeah.
There's too many dang games, 162 and 185 days, or whatever it is. Man, no, we got to shorten this bad boy up." And I think that was on the Jacoby show.
Did Papelbon play with him?
Is Papelbon the one saying that he hates
baseball? But did Papelbon play with him? This is where I got confused.
Papelbon was a Nat in 2016.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right. And a very disliked one.
And for 2015, for the end of 2015.
But that was the year that they had fights in the dugout and people didn't like Papelbon. I remember that very much.
Papelbon, let me be clear. Jonathan Papelbon is one of the least liked players when he played in the game. Let me also be clear. Jonathan Papelbon was an absolute jerk to me my first year at MLB when I had to cover some little event, a charity event that he was doing. You know, you go to all these events because you're the lowest person on the totem pole and you get a few quotes and you go home and you write your little, "Look, this player is doing this great initiative thing for MLB.com.
Oh, God.
Totally awful jerk. Kept brushing me off. Like, I was the only reporter there. It was a charity event. I just needed a couple quotes. I was 21 years old, so then I could go write my story.
Was he young too?
You see, I'm busy. Like, leave me alone. Like, yeah.
Was he young too?
Yes.
He was young too?
Yes. He was brash. He was.
Yeah, because like the veterans would have been like, "I know what you're doing here. You're the only person here. The whole reason we're doing this is to give like this charity some love. So I can give you like three canned comments. Like, it's not like you're asking me to, like, you're not going to get, there's no gotcha here. There's no like, no. I'm just going to, this is for the kids. It's all about the kids. I love kids, you know, boom."
So I want to make that clear right away before we get into the Anthony Rendon. The Jonathan Papelbon isn't the best messenger when it comes to the game's integrity.
I don't think you have to.
Like, somebody else could have spoke out about that. One, two, many players think the game should be shortened.
Yeah.
The season should be shortened. That wasn't controversial. It was controversial because Anthony Rendon, who I did cover in DC, and actually, I don't have anything bad to say about him. I think as a person, how good Anthony Rendon is. Now, is he someone who loves baseball? No, not really. Is he someone who's very good at baseball? Yes. So you have these two things kind of converging, and you have someone who, isn't the best messenger to say the game, that there's too many games. But it isn't controversial that he said that. It's controversial because he's never on the field, right? And he never speaks. And every time he speaks, he says, this is Anthony. This is why he doesn't speak, because he says what pops into his head, whether it's right or not right for the moment. And then he gets in trouble. Like, he used to do this in DC too. He'd be like not talking for a while. And then he'd sit and talk and be like, "Well, I don't know how hard hit that ball was. Can't you guys stat cast it or do this and do that?" And like, he's always very jokey and very personable and like doesn't think before he speaks. So I was shocked that, one, he gave the interview, and two, that he thought that he would be a good messenger for the shorten the season campaign when his seasons are basically non-existent. I just keep wondering, guys. And I've had people say this to me too. It's like, what is the end goal here with Anthony Rendon? Do they just get together, him and maybe not Perry Minasian, you know, because I don't think Perry
Ron said he's got something circled. He's going to talk to him.
Yeah. But that was going to be Buck's first move. If he got the job too, was like drive to Texas and get Rendon on board. I don't think anybody can at this point in time. I'm wondering when they sit down with them and say, "Listen, what's it going to cost us for you to retire?" Correct. What is it going to cost us for you to retire? Because I don't think he's someone who's going to stop playing, guys, and we're never going to hear from him again. He's going to go.
He's not going to vanish.
He's going to go to right. No. He's going to go to like the remote woods in Montana, or like he's from Texas. And I often wonder if he regrets not signing with Texas because, you know, he got all the money, he got more money in Anaheim, but he probably would have been left alone a little bit more in Texas. He wouldn't have been such a high paid, high profile guy. He would have been behind a lot of these other guys. I often wonder, and he would have been home in Texas. I don't think he really fits in well with the California lifestyle. And so I wonder if he regrets not signing in Texas at all. But for me, guys, the only ending for Anthony Rendon eventually is, are they going to sit down and say, "Listen, this is what we will pay you to retire. to be done with this, because right now it's kind of like just this weight, this like dead anger weight on the organization. And I think people think that he's soft, or, you know, I don't think any of that is true.
Well, there was some stuff about his knee, like I saw that he actually had a personal look at his knee that had a different answer than
correct.
The Angels. Like there was bleeding, and there was like a bigger deal than what the Angels
said. Than the Angels had said, yes. And so I don't think that is true. That narrative bothers me. Does the guy like live and breathe baseball? No, that is true. He doesn't. But people forget that he had like huge, huge injuries coming out of Rice. There was a reason his draft stock plummeted.
That's a good point,
because
too.
He basically had fully repaired ankles. Like he's a very like old, however, I don't know how old he is, but his body is much older than his actual age, right? And people forget that. Like, he was hurt in DC a lot. Like his body is beat up, I think, from all the high level college he played, from having a repaired ankle. Like anyone who's twisted their ankle knows your ankle's never the same again. Now imagine a surgically repaired ankle when you're playing third base.
That's
right.
So this is a Carlos Correa, like is nodding along here.
Right, well, so I do think that there is some truth to some of the shade Anthony Rendon gets. He absolutely deserves some of this other stuff. I think people just like kind of see what they want to see, and he doesn't do a good job articulating things either.
And just,
that makes it worse.
I think just, you know, on the like shortening the season thing, like, you know, people forget that the season once was shorter. Like we had a whole part of history of baseball where it was 154 games. Like, you know, 162 is, you know, newish. So it's just a number that we can manipulate however we like. Now, what happened with the new rules that I don't like is that we are our media, and we work during baseball games, and the players are players and they work during baseball games. Everybody that is within sort of baseball's insular, you know, bubble works during baseball games. So when someone says, here's a pitch clock, you're going to work less, on some level, all of us are going to be like, ha ha, like that. But then there are people who are like, damn, man, I just missed an inning and a half getting a beer. Like, you know, there's a little bit different of like if you play during this time. So if you like, I would rather at least the fans somehow get a seat at the table before the rule is changed, so that like maybe the pitch clock, most fans, like it's like sort of 60, 2/3 kind of like the pitch clock. So it ended up being a good one. But if you ask most fans, do you think they'd want fewer games? I don't know. I don't know that they would just.
I think you'd have a lot of people who are hardcore fans that would complain about it and hate it. It's, oh, it's less baseball. That's terrible.
Yeah, because baseball is every day. That's like, it's like the thing you turn on. It's every day.
I think casual fans would be fine.
Too.
I mean, ticket price demand would theoretically go up, right?
Yes. Tickets would go up.
So it becomes more expensive to go. And the games are shorter. So you're mad. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to these shorter games. There's not that many of them. But if you're lopping off April, the worst weather month of the season, I wouldn't cut 8 games from the season, because I think that's meaningless. I think that's almost nothing. Why even bother?
Like,
one day a week off would make sense.
But I would also take
a month off.
That would be actually 24. That'd be 24.
Oh, yeah, taking April off would be amazing, because it is the worst month. Like, weather-wise,
weather month.
It's so early that like fan interest is so low after opening day. Like, agreed.
We get more of an off season. Spring training is in April.
Yeah, I do want to point out, you had a good point about the new rules. So MLB just tweaked them again.
I know,
they're
it's
like
even shorter.
Shortening things even more. I had a bunch of players who like were like, okay, the media is not going to write it, which is true. Because again, someone asks you to work 7 hours instead of 8, and now they're asking you to work 6.5. You're not complaining, right? Uh-huh. Your pay is the same. But like, it is becoming speedball a bit here now, right? Wasn't the whole point originally to cut out the dead time? But isn't the dead time been cut? Like, what are we doing now? Besides maybe accelerating injuries, how much more can we squeeze out of this game? You know what I mean? Like, and
baseball
players
responds with like, the injuries aren't up, blah, blah, blah. And that might be true, but injury is not something that just happens in 1 year. It's like,
correct.
Especially if you're just increasing the fatigue that the players are under, that's something that'll start showing up, you know, maybe even 3, 4, 5 years into a guy's career. Like if you just imagine 3 years of this level and 3 years of more fatigue, like, that person with the 3 years of more fatigue, they may end up with an injury at the end that the other one wouldn't have. So it's really hard to be like, nope, there's no injury concerns with the pitch clock. You know, we've done it for a year. It's fine.
Well, and are we jamming in less game to shove more commercials into these 3-hour slots, right? Like, what are we doing here? What is the end goal here? I think people were okay with the new rules initially, but like, are we going to keep chopping and chopping? Because players, and you know, and this is on the players too.
Should have left it alone for a year. Like, we had such a tumultuous year. Yeah, let it breathe, man. Just leave it alone for a year.
I know. And like MLB, as so people may not realize, has unilateral power to enforce new rules. The players don't have to agree. And that was a big mistake in the CBA, that the players let that go and haven't fought for that. And I wonder if, you know, now the next CBA, they will fight for that now, because they have no control now. MLB can say the pitch clock's down to 3 seconds, and like, they would just have to adapt. That's it. You're done. And I just wonder, I think it's a slippery slope, and I think none of us are writing it. Let's go. It's just speedball. They just take it and go. They just take it and go. Keep going.
Got the ball, go.
just, I mean, velocity seriously, though.
Velocity would drop. Yeah. Yes, it would. It would finally drop if you'd made the pitch clock 3 seconds. We could finally get Velo down.
What happens often? These guys would be breathing heavy off the mound, like, just gassed.
Just guy passes out on the mound. Jesus.
I'm just thinking of like Bartolo Colon trying to survive new cardio land of pitching. Oh God.
It'd be amazing if he surprised you and was like surprisingly good in that environment.
Because how much Velo is he going to lose? He's like, I can do this at 79. It's fine.
Yeah, got this all day. No problem whatsoever.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I thought we should talk about the Red Sox on today's show for just a little bit. I saw the clips of Sam Kennedy and Tom Warner getting booed over the weekend at the Sox Winterfest, which I think has happened 2 years in a row now. And this is a team that is not acting the way you would expect it to from a payroll position. And I can't really figure out why. For the first time since Kotz has been tracking payrolls, which goes back to 2000, the Red Sox are on track to be outside the top 10 in payroll. Usually they're in the top 5. Right now they're not even in the top 10. And based on the comments they're making and their actual decision making they're making lately, there's no indication they're going to correct that. Like, this is very much a roster that looks like it's close to what you're going to have come opening day this year. And Britt, I'll throw this to you first. I mean, if there are even greater constraints on Craig Breslow than there were on Chaim Bloom with the payroll, how exactly are things going to be different for the Red Sox?
Well, they won't be. I mean, as we record this, I have a column that will be posted Wednesday morning on this, because I think it's not getting enough attention, what the Red Sox are doing, because it's an absolute cluster over there. And I do think Craig Breslow has an advantage over Chaim Bloom is that Chaim Bloom inherited a farm system that was just garbage. It was one of the worst in baseball. And Chaim Bloom was tasked with making that better, and now they are better. Now they have legitimate, you know, like a big three of prospects who could be ready the end of this year, but really we're talking about 25, right? So Craig Breslow at least has some stuff in the pipeline, but is anybody convinced that even if these big three come up, and it's the Red Sox time to shine, that this ownership group is going to go out and be the Red Sox of old again? I can't sit here and say yes, right? Like, I think if you look at the Red Sox, the problem has been nobody knows what's going on. Like, are they trying to win now? Because for a while they tried to convince us they were. Now it's pretty clear they walked back their full throttle comments, Tom Warner did, from earlier in the winter, So, you know, I hope they didn't convince Craig Breslow with this full throttle nonsense and say, Craig, we're going to give you, you know, X amount of dollars and then take it away in January, because the Red Sox haven't done anything. And Werner said, oh, you know, I misspoke, which is like always the best thing, right? Somebody says something like, we're going to go full throttle. The fans get all excited. They do nothing. The fans boo them. And they're like, whoa, I didn't mean, I meant like full throttle. Like, we're trying to be good in all areas of the organization. And it's like, dude, that's not what full throttle means. Like, full throttle is like the Dodgers offseason.
We hired a pitching coordinator.
Words mean something. There are many, many words to choose from.
Yes. I also think that if you're dealing with a rabid fan base like the Boston Red Sox, just be honest. If the goal was never to spend this winter, if the goal was to always wait for these big three, then just say, we are going to spend when these three get up here in 2025. Be patient. You know, we've asked you to be like, just be honest, because if you're a Red Sox fan now, you feel lied to no matter what, because they've told so many different versions of the truth that like that you're not sure which end is up. It kind of will make you dizzy if you think about it, right? They hired Dave Dombrowski to win. He wins. They fire him. They hire Chaim Bloom to make the minor league system better. He does that. They fire him. Like, what is Craig Breslow supposed to do here to keep his job? Exactly. Right? Is there a way Craig Breslow keeps his job just based on the way ownership has worked? I think the whole problem is the top, the whims of the top. The carousel on the Red Sox just keeps spinning and nobody has any clue where they're headed. Nobody has any clue what ownership's going to wake up and say, oh yeah, we need to go for it. Or no, we're good with the long-term plan. Like, if they finish in last this year, which will probably happen, has a good chance of happening, they're projected to, does ownership still say we're playing the long game? Or do they once again like pull the carpet out from under Craig Breslow and say we must win now, even if we're not ready to win now? I think, just don't understand what they're doing.
I think they're, as an ownership group, pretty swift to make decisions. But I also think, with Craig Breslow, I think he gets one freebie year, because this is ownership's decision. There's no big trade or signature move that Breslow has made that you'd look at the end of 2024 and say, well, we got to let Craig go. He made a huge mistake right away. They're not going to do that. I think in order to keep his job, I think it's a 3-year window. I think they got to make the playoffs in each of the final two seasons of that window. If they don't make it this year, I think he's okay. But to your point, I always look at over or under win totals and World Series odds to get a sense of just what the betting market thinks of a team. The Red Sox are 40-1 to win the World Series. That's about as long as you ever see the Red Sox odds-wise to win a World Series. And their over-under win total is 79.5. You don't see this very often. I think that the prospects they have are actually very good. It's a good point that under Chaim Bloom, this system did get a lot better. Roman Anthony, Marcella Mayer, Kyle Teal, all guys that are going to be pretty key long-term pieces for them, they're close. We're going to see probably a good bit of Sedan Rafaela, who was one of their top prospects and still is a prospect eligible player now. We're going to see a lot of him this year. So they're going to get a lot younger really fast. They've spent a bit in recent off seasons. If this is a 1-year blip, I think all can be forgiven pretty quickly.
I'm going to push back a little bit.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Devil's advocate here. I don't see a huge reduction in spending. Yes, maybe. From like the sort of early 2000s, you know, from 2004 to 2008, they were the second highest payroll every year. Maybe they are stepping back from that. But in terms of being top five, but sort of back end top five, that's where they've settled. So if they went and signed Jordan Montgomery to like a $15 million deal, they'd end up with the, you know, average annual deal, they'd end up with the sixth or seventh highest payroll, and they'd be right around that first apron. You know, so I don't think it's that drastic of a change in money outlay. I think that what there is a realization that this team goes where their pitching goes. And I had that in my mailbag, that if you just look at their runs allowed and their wins, they kind of go where their pitching goes. And I think that it's tough to really change an entire pitching staff just with money. Now, yes, there's been teams that have done it. And the Rangers come to mind, but then also look at what actual Rangers squad pitched their way through the World Series. And I wouldn't say that that was an amazing rotation. So I think that the Green Monster creates an actual problem for pitching in Boston that they need to solve. And so I think that they hired Chaim Bloom to like do that work underneath the hood and improve. And I think what I've heard happen is like he hired a lot of people, but there wasn't a great structure. And so the pitching part didn't really come together. Brian Bello is exciting. I think he's exciting. Cutter Crawford is interesting. Tanner Houck is interesting. But they needed more success, more top-end success out of their pitching than they got. And so Craig Breslow is obviously a pitching hire. He was a VP that had pitching in his role in Chicago. He comes and he hires a new pitching coordinator. He assigns Kyle Bodey to be an advisor from Driveline. So there's been a couple of things that he's doing to try and change pitching leadership there. So I don't know. I don't like that they cycle through leadership so fast because I think things take a while to come into place. But at the same time, like I think this is like all their moves for the last 6 years have been how do we develop pitching in this ballpark? And once that gets going, you know, I think they could push back into top five territory. I mean, it's not like they cut 80 million out. You know, we're talking about 20, 30 million that separates them from the top five.
But why can't they spend to the tax is my question. What, are they going for it or not? Like the messaging is confusing.
Yeah, I mean, they have $10. They have $10 million to the first apron. There's something weird about how things are reported, but their CBT tax is $226 right now, so they're not actually that far from the first apron.
And they should spend up to it. I mean, they have the money
for
coming
sure.
In.
I think maybe to some extent you heard some comments from Craig Breslow just being like, we weren't a match for the free agents. It does bring to mind sort of the Friedman comments, which is if you always want to sign a guy at your number, you're never going to sign a guy. You know, yeah. Like you have to overpay at some point to get a person. But I just don't know, you know, that it's so dire. Like I feel like this is like if you just think about they want to figure out how to develop pitching. A lot of their moves have been consistent over the last few years.
Well, I think that's where bringing in Kyle Bodey as a special advisor makes a lot of sense, right? You're not spending on Jordan Montgomery, but you're investing in the longer term future of the organization, spending a lot fewer dollars to have Kyle there than you would on Jordan Montgomery and probably getting more benefits in the long run. So if you're solving a long term problem and you're not overpaying for pitching that you don't really believe in on a 4 or 5 year deal, maybe you are making yourself more likely to have sustained success. It's just a little strange to see a team like this dipping relative to the other big spenders. That's the part that I can't quite get on board with, is that they should never really pull back that much. There's a handful of teams that should always be full throttle. That's like the mindset I have about them even before those comments ever made. It's like you're the Red Sox. You don't take years off.
Yeah, and it's like, what does ownership want, too? Like, did they tell Breslow, like, we want to win? Or did they tell him to keep staying on the Heim path, right? Like, because both of those paths, winning and the Heim path, got people fired.
Oh, man.
So I just don't know where the win is for Craig Breslow.
I think that's the fairest way to criticize the Boston Red Sox. It's like, Jesus, you fired a guy after he won you a World Series.
And then you fired a guy who did what you hired him to do, right, which was fix our system. Like you can't
win for losing in Boston.
Yeah, like that's what I don't understand. I think all the problems are at the top because like if they finish in last place this year, are they going to say, okay, Craig, it's okay. We know we're building for the future. Or are they going to pull this stuff that they pull, which is like, we're the Red Sox. We got to win. So our fans think we're trying to win, even though we're not really trying to win. Right. Like that to me is so confusing.
Last thought here before we go, looking at the World Series odds for the entire division for the AL East, these are all from BetMGM. The Yankees are plus 900, the Orioles are plus 1600, the Blue Jays are plus 2000, and the Rays are plus 3500. So thinking about that over under win total at 79.5 for the Red Sox, the plus 4000 to win the World Series, someone has to finish last in this division. There is not a bad team in the AL East right now. Like you could be decent and still finish last. That's possible. It's not going to make people happy. Oh, we took last, but we were decent. It's just the way it is. Do you believe the Red Sox are better than any other team in the AL East in 2024? You know, because you seem to be more optimistic about them than Britt and I are.
The Red Sox.
Yes or no, you know?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Where's my maple syrup? I need to keep syrup at the desk.
No.
They're not hopeless. They're not clueless. No. They're not.
That's why my only hesitation is like they're not that far from a 500 team. You know, they're sort of middle of the pack. But in the AL,
they're the Red Sox.
Yeah, and it's also the AL East. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the spending.
But I also think that right now, if you think about their team, all of the variance is in the pitching squad. So if like, you know, if Cutter Crawford is like an above average good starting pitcher this year, if Brian Bayo is like really good, if Lucas Giolito refines his form, I know these are all ifs, but like that's how they're built. They're like, we're going to keep running out of great offense and we're going to try and figure out pitching and we're just
Their defense too. If their defense is better. Their defense was atrocious.
Right. Taking Duren out of center, more Rafaela in center.
Trevor Story being healthy.
Yeah. I think the defense will get better, but it's all about the pitching in my estimation in terms of like if they're good or not this year.
Yeah. It's going to make a big, big difference. You look at the way the lineup's built, Devers, Cassis, Yoshida, even Vaughn Grissom projected to be everyday players that are well above average. Tyler O'Neill, probably a near everyday player. He's also in that projection. Then a couple of part-time guys before you get to the likes of Duran and some of the young guys. A Trevor Story bounce back would go a long way towards making this lineup even deeper as well. I think seeing him completely healthy at least makes that a possibility. But strange times in Boston, at least for 2024. It might not be a long time at the bottom, but it could be a quick trip to the basement for this Red Sox team. We are going to sign off on our way out the door. A reminder, you can get a subscription to The Athletic for $2 a month at theathletic.com/baseball show. That'll cover you for the first year, so a pretty good rate on that. You can find Britt on Twitter at Britt_Giroli. You can find Eno at EnoSaris. I am at Derek Van Riper. That's going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. We're back with you next week.
Always got the green light here.
Green light.